For the tether, like a bridle cast upon the irrational part of the soul, whenever it pulls back hard, brings on what is called repentance for sins, and for those pleasures that are lawless and uncontrolled, shame, a pain, and a stinging of the soul from this source, as it is checked by the ruling and governing power. Until chastened in this way, it becomes obedient, and like a tame creature, grows accustomed, without blow or pain, to perceive the daimon's wishes swiftly, through signs and tokens alone. These souls, then, are brought and settled toward what is fitting only late and slowly. But from those docile and obedient ones, from the very beginning and birth of their own daimon, comes also the prophetic and God-inspired class of men, of whom you have surely heard of the soul of Hermodorus of Clazomene, how it would leave the body altogether by night and by day and wander far and wide, and then return again, having encountered and been present at many things said and done far away. Until, his wife having betrayed him, his enemies seized his body, empty of its soul, and burned it at home. This story, however, is not true, for the soul did not leave the body. Rather, always yielding and loosening the tether to the daimon, it gave it a circuit and a range of roaming, so that, seeing and hearing much of what was outside, it reported it back. But those who destroyed the body while it slept are, even now, paying the penalty for it in Tartarus. These things you will know more clearly, young man, in the third month. For now, go. When the voice had ceased, Timarchus said he wished to turn and see who the speaker was, but he felt his head ache severely again, as though violently compressed, and could no longer perceive or be aware of anything around him. Then, after a little while coming to himself, he saw that he was lying in the shrine of Trophonius near the entrance, where he had lain down at the start. Such, then, is the tale of Timarchus. And since, on coming to Athens, he died in the third month after the voice had occurred to him, we, in amazement, reported it to Socrates, and Socrates reproached us for not having told it to him while Timarchus was still alive. For he would gladly have questioned him further and examined him more closely about it. You now have, Theocritus, both the argument and the tale together, but see whether we ought also to summon our guest here to join in the inquiry, for it belongs to men of divine nature and is very much their concern. But why, he said, does Epaminondas not contribute his own view, drawing on the same considerations as we? And my father, smiling, said, such, stranger, is his character. Silent and guarded in speech, yet insatiable in learning and listening. That is why Spintharus of Tarentum, who spent no little time with him here, always says, I believe, that he has met no man who knew more and said less. So you, then, tell us yourself what you think about what has been said. Well then, he said, I hold that the story of Timarchus ought to be set aside as sacred and inviolate, dedicated to the god. But I am amazed if some are going to disbelieve what Simmias has said about it, when they name swans and serpents and dogs and horses as sacred, yet refuse to believe that men can be divine and beloved of the gods, and this while holding that the god loves not birds but mankind. Just as a lover of horses does not care equally for all of that kind, but always singling out and setting apart someone that is best, trains and rears and loves it above the rest. So too those above us, marking out the best of us as if from a herd, deem them worthy of a special and superior guidance, directing them not by bit and rein, but by reason, through signs, signs of which the many, the common herd, are altogether ignorant. For the many dogs do not understand the signals of the hunt, nor the many horses those of horsemanship, but only those that have been trained, perceiving at once, from some chance hiss or click of the tongue, what is commanded, and readily settling into what is required. Homer, too, appears to recognize the very distinction we are speaking of, for among the seers he calls some interpreters of birds and priests, while others, who understand and are attuned when the gods themselves converse, he supposes declare the future, as in the line where he says, and Helenus, dear son of Priam, took to heart a counsel that pleased the gods in their deliberation, for thus I heard the voice of the gods who live forever. For just as some perceive and know the intention of kings and generals from outside, by certain beacon fires and proclamations and trumpet calls, while to their trusted intimates they declare it themselves, so too the divine encounters few, and rarely, by itself directly, but to the many it gives signs, out of which the so-called art of divination is constituted. For the gods order the life of only a few men, those whom they wish to render supremely blessed and truly divine. but souls that have been released from birth and are now at leisure from the body, set entirely free, as it were, are daimons who care for mankind, according to Hesiod. For just as retired athletes, given up to old age, are not wholly abandoned by their love of honor and of bodily exercise, but take delight in watching others train, and encourage them and run alongside them, so too those who have ceased from the contests of life, having become daimons through the virtue of their soul, do not entirely disdain the affairs and words and pursuits of this world, but being kindly disposed to those who strive for the same goal and sharing their ambition for virtue. They urge them on and join in the effort, whenever they see them already near their hope, straining and just touching it. For it is not to whoever chances to be there that the divine lends its aid. Rather, just as, among swimmers in the sea, those still far out and heading further from the shore are watched in silence by those standing on land, while those already close by are run alongside and even waded out too, helped by both hand and voice, and so brought to safety. In just this way is the manner of the divine toward us, who are being swamped by our circumstances and taking on many bodies as though changing vehicles. It lets us struggle and hold out ourselves, trying through our own virtue to be saved and to reach harbor. But whatever soul has already, through countless births, contended long and hard, striving well and eagerly, and as its cycle is being brought to completion, is in danger and, straining ambitiously toward its escape, comes up drenched in sweat. To that soul God does not begrudge its own daimon's help, but lets it go to whoever is eager for it, and each daimon is eager, in turn, to save a different soul that calls upon it. And the soul hearkens because of its nearness and is saved, but if it does not obey, the daimon abandons it and it does not fare well. When this had been said, Epaminondas, looking at me, said, "For you, Caphisias, it is nearly time to go to the gymnasium and not to be absent from your companions. We will look after Athena ourselves, once we have broken up this gathering, whenever it seems best." And I said, "Let us do so, but I think this man Theocritus here wishes to have a brief word with me and with Galaxidorus." "Good fortune attend it," he said, "let him speak," and rising, he went ahead to the bend of the colonnade, and we, gathering around him, tried to urge him toward the undertaking. He said he knew quite clearly the day of the exile's return, and that he had arranged with Gorgidas and their friends for the occasion, that they would put no citizen to death without trial, unless great necessity should arise, and that, besides, it suited their purpose with the mass of the Thebans that there should be some who were blameless and clear of what was done, who would therefore be able to advise the people without suspicion, as speaking from the best motives. This seemed good to us. And he withdrew again to Simmias and his companions, while we went down to the gymnasium and met with our friends, and each of us, drawing another aside as we wrestled together, partly inquired and partly informed and made arrangements for the undertaking. We also saw Archias and Philip, freshly anointed, on their way to dinner. For Philidas, fearing they might do away with Amphithyus beforehand, had gone straight from escorting Lysanoridas to receive Archias, and, raising his hopes about the woman he happened to desire, as if she would come to the drinking party, persuaded him to turn to ease and relaxation with those accustomed to share his dissipation. It was already late, and the cold grew sharper as a wind came up, and because of this most people had withdrawn more quickly into their houses. So we met with Damocles and Pelopidas and Theopompus and brought them in, and others brought in others still. For they had split up as soon as they crossed Cithaeron, and the storm allowed them, with their faces muffled, to pass through the city unnoticed. To some there flashed lightning on the right, without thunder, as they entered through the gates, and the signs seemed favorable, pointing to safety and glory, as though the enterprise would be brilliant but without danger. So when we were all inside, 48 in number, with Theocritus already by himself sacrificing in a little chamber, there came a great pounding at the door. And after a moment, someone arrived reporting that two servants of Archias had been sent in haste to knock at Charon's outer door, to summon Charon, and were ordering it to be opened and growing angry that no one answered quickly. Charon, thrown into confusion, at once ordered it opened for them, while he himself went out to meet them wearing a garland, as though he had been sacrificing and drinking, and asked the servants what they wanted. One of them said, "Archias and Philip sent us to order you to come to them as quickly as possible." When Karen asked what the urgency was for such a summons at that hour, and whether there was anything unusual, "We know nothing more," the servant said, "but what shall we tell them?" "Why, by Zeus," said Karen, "tell them that as soon as I have set aside my garland and taken up my cloak, I will follow you, for if I go walking with you at this hour, I would alarm some people, as if I were being led off under arrest." "Do just that," they said, "for we too must carry an order from the magistrates to the garrison guards in the city." So they departed. But when Karen had come into us and told us this, terror seized us all, thinking we had been betrayed, and most of us suspected Hippo's Tenetas, who had tried to stop the return through Clidon, and, since he had failed and the danger was now bound up with the moment, was thought likely, out of fear, to have divulged the plan. For he had not come with the others to the house, and altogether seemed to have turned base and unreliable. Nevertheless, we all thought Karen must go and obey when summoned by the magistrates. He then bade his son come forward, the finest of the Theban boys, Archidamus, and the most devoted to the gymnasium, about 15 years old but far surpassing his contemporaries in strength and stature, and said, "Men, this boy is my only son and my beloved, as you know. I entrust him to you, calling on all the gods and all the daimons to witness. If I should show myself base toward you, kill him, spare us not at all. But for the rest, good men, set yourselves against whatever befalls, and do not let your bodies be destroyed shamefully and ignobly at the hands of the basest men, but defend yourselves, keeping your souls unconquered for your fatherland." As Karen said this, we admired his spirit and his nobility, but were indignant at the suspicion, and urged that the boy, for it is not honorable that he too should fall into the hands of our enemies. "No, dare beyond your years, my boy, and taste of necessary trials, and face danger together with many good citizens on behalf of freedom and virtue. Much hope still remains, and surely one of the gods looks down upon us as we contend for justice." Many of us, Archidamus, were moved to tears by these words of the man. But Charon himself, without a tear, unmoved, put his son into Pelopidas's hands and went out through the door, greeting each of us and giving encouragement. And you would have admired still more the boy's own brightness and fearlessness in the face of danger. Like Neoptolemus, he neither paled nor was struck with terror, but drew Pelopidas's sword and examined it closely. At this point, Cephisodorus, son of Diotinus, one of our friends, came to us carrying a sword and wearing an iron breastplate underneath his clothes. And learning of Charon's summons by Archias, he blamed us for our delay and at once urged us to march on the houses of the tyrants, saying that it was better to strike first before they could fall upon us. Or else, if not that, better to go out and grapple with them in the open, scattered and unformed against each other, than to remain shut up in a small house like a swarm of bees waiting to be smoked out by the enemy. The seer Theocritus also urged us on, saying that the sacrificial signs had proved favorable and safe and reliable for us. While we were arming and forming up, Charon arrived again, his face cheerful, smiling, and looking at us, he bade us take courage, since nothing terrible was afoot, but the business was proceeding on its course. "For Archias," he said, "and Philip, when they heard that I had come as summoned, were already heavy with drink and their souls as relaxed as their bodies, they barely got up and came out to the doors. And when Archias said, 'We hear, Charon, that exiles have slipped into the city and are hiding here,' I was greatly disturbed and said, 'Where are they said to be and who are they?' 'We do not know,' said Archias, 'and that is why we sent for you, in case you happen to have heard something more definite.' And I, recovering my wits a little as if from a blow, reasoned that the report was not a reliable one, and that the plot had not been betrayed by any of those in on it. For surely, they would not be ignorant of the house, if someone with exact knowledge had informed on us. Rather, some vague suspicion or rumor circulating in the city had reached them by other means. So I said to him, 'While Androcletus was alive, I know that such rumors often circulated for nothing, and false reports troubled us. But now,' I said, 'I have heard nothing of the kind, Archias. Still, I will look into the matter if you order it, and if I learn anything worth attention, it will not escape you.' 'Indeed,' said Philidas, 'leave nothing, Charon, unexamined or uninquired concerning this. For what is to prevent us from despising nothing, but being on guard and attentive to everything? Foresight and security are fine things.' And at the same time, he took hold of Archias and led him back into the room where they happened to be drinking. But let us not delay, gentlemen, he said. Let us pray to the gods and go out. When Charon had said this, we prayed to the gods and encouraged one another. It was now the hour at which people are mostly occupied with dinner, and the wind, growing stronger, was already stirring up snow mixed with a fine drizzle, so that there was great emptiness as we made our way through the narrow streets. Those assigned against Leontiades and Hypates, who lived near one another, went out in cloaks, carrying no weapon but a dagger each. Among them were Pelopidas, Damoclides, and Cephisodorus. Charon and Melon and those with them, who were about to attack Archias's group, put on light corslets and wore thick wreaths, some of fur, some of pine, and some even wrapped themselves in women's tunics, imitating drunken men engaged in a revel with women. But fortune, Archidamus, a harsher power, evening out the softness and ignorance of our enemies against our own daring and preparation, and, as if embroidering our action from the start like a drama with episodes of danger, ran together into the very deed itself, bringing on a sharp and terrible struggle of unexpected reversal. For after Charon, having reassured Archias and Philip, had withdrawn home and was preparing us for the action, a letter arrived here from you, from Archias the Hierophant, to that other Archias, who was, it seems, his friend and guest friend, announcing the return and the plot of the exiles, and the house into which they had come, and their fellow conspirators. Archias, already flooded with drink and excited with expectation of the women, received the letter. But when the letter carrier said it concerned serious matters, he said, "Serious matters, then, till tomorrow," and put the letter under his pillow. Then, calling for a cup, he ordered it filled, and kept sending Philidas out repeatedly to the door to see whether the women were approaching. While such hope was managing the drinking party in this way, we approached, and pushing our way at once past the servants toward the men's hall, we stood a moment at the doors, surveying each of those reclining there. The sight of the wreaths and the clothing, mistaking our appearance for a group visiting on other business, produced silence. But when Melon first rushed through the middle with his hand laid on the hilt of his sword, Cabarichus, the archon chosen by lot, seizing him by the arm as he passed, cried out, "Is this not Melon, Philidas?" Melon at once struck down this attempt with his sword as he drew it, and running at Archias, who was struggling to rise, did not stop striking until he had killed him. Philip, Charon wounded in the neck, and as he defended himself with the cups lying near him, Lysithias threw him from the couch to the ground and finished him off. As for Cabarichus, we tried to calm him, urging him not to help the tyrants, but to help liberate his fatherland along with us, for he held a sacred office and was consecrated to the gods on her behalf. But since, on account of the wine, he was not easily brought round by reasoning to what was advantageous, but rose up agitated and confused, and leveled his spear point forward, the spear which our archons by custom always carry. I, seizing the spear in the middle and raising it above his head, shouted at him to let go and save himself, or else be struck. And Theopompus, standing at his right and striking him with his sword, said, "Lie there now with those you flattered. May you never be crowned in a free Thebes, nor ever again sacrifice to the gods against whom you so often invoked curses on your fatherland on behalf of our enemies." When Cabarichus had fallen, Theocritus, who was present, snatched up the sacred spear out of the slaughter. And of the servants, we killed the few who dared to resist, but those who kept quiet we shut up in the men's hall, not wishing them to slip away and report what had been done before we knew whether our companions' business had also gone well. That other business was carried out in this manner. Pelopidas and his men came quietly up to Leontiades' courtyard door and knocked, and told the servant who answered that they had come bringing a letter from Callistratus at Athens for Leontiades. When he had reported this, and being ordered, drew back the bolt and opened the door a little, they burst in all together, knocked the man down, and rushed at a run through the courtyard toward the bedroom. Leontiades, at once grasping the truth from his suspicion and drawing his dagger, rushed to defend himself, an unjust man and tyrannical, but strong in spirit and vigorous of hand. He did not, however, think to knock over the lamp and mix with his attackers in the dark, but, seen in the light by them just as the door was being opened, struck Cephisodorus in the flank, and then, closing with Pelopidas' second, shouted loudly and called for his servants. But these were held back by Samidas and his men, who did not dare to come to close quarters with the most distinguished of the citizens, men who far excelled them in strength. Pelopidas fought hand to hand with Leontiades, a sword fight at the narrow doors of the bedroom, and with Cephisodorus fallen in the very doorway and dying, the rest could not come to their aid. At last our man, taking a wound to the head that was not severe, dealt many blows and brought Leontiades down, and slew him over the still warm body of Cephisodorus. For the man saw his enemy falling and gave his right hand to Pelopidas, and, embracing the others with a smile, breathed his last content. From there they turned to Hypates, and when the doors were opened for them in the same way, they caught Hypates fleeing over a roof into the neighbor's house and killed him. From there they hurried to join us and met us outside near the colonnade of many pillars. Greeting one another and conferring together, we went on to the prison. Philidas called out the man in charge of the jail and said, "Archias and Philip order you to bring Amphitheus to them at once." But the jailer, seeing how strange the hour was and that Philidas was not speaking in his usual manner, but was excited and agitated by the struggle, suspected the trick and said, "At this hour, Philidas, did the polemarch send for a prisoner? And through you, and what token do you bring?" And as he spoke, Philidas, holding a cavalry lance, drove it through his side and struck down the wretched man, whom, even by day, not a few women trampled and spat upon. We then broke down the doors of the jail and called out by name first Amphitheus, then each of the others, as each of us had a particular attachment. Those who recognized the voice leapt up gladly from their pallets, dragging their chains behind them. Others, whose feet were bound in the stocks, stretched out their hands and cried out, begging not to be left behind. As these were being freed, many of those living nearby, perceiving what was happening and rejoicing, now came flocking to us. And the women, as each heard about her own kinsmen, no longer keeping to the customs of Boeotian women, ran out to one another and asked those they met for news. And those who found their fathers or husbands followed along, and no one prevented them, for the pity, tears, and entreaties of virtuous women weighed heavily on those they met. While this was happening, learning that Epaminondas and Gorgidas were already gathering with their friends around the temple of Athena, I went to join them. And many good citizens came together there, with ever more streaming in continually. When I reported to them everything that had been done, point by point, and urged them to come and help in the marketplace, all at once began proclaiming freedom to the citizens. And weapons were supplied to the crowds, then assembling by the colonnades, which were full of spoils of every kind, and by the workshops of the knife makers who lived nearby. Hippostenides, too, arrived with his friends and servants, gathering up trumpeters who happened to be in town for the festival of Heracles. At once some sounded their trumpets in the marketplace, others in different places, throwing our opponents into confusion from every side, as though the whole city had risen. So that some, even setting fire to the Cadmea, fled, dragging along with them even those said to be their superiors, who were accustomed to spend the night below near the citadel. Those above, meanwhile, seeing this disordered and panicked flow of men below, and looking out toward us in the marketplace, no part of the city being quiet, but noise and uproar rising from every direction, did not resolve to come down, although they numbered about 5,000. Struck with fear at the danger, they made excuses of another kind, pretending they were waiting for Lysanoridas, since he was expected that very day. For this reason, as we later learned, the Spartan elders fined him heavily. But Heripidas and Arcesus they put to death at once, seizing them at Corinth, and they handed over the Cadmea to us under truce and departed with their soldiers.